Working Cows Podcast, Episode 99.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network, here with another episode, and today we are talking to Morgan Hartman. Morgan is a grazer from the upstate of New York, as well as a holistic management instructor, and he's got lots of experience, been nationally recognized for what he's done in grazing, and has lots of wisdom and knowledge, and I am excited to talk to Morgan. So, Morgan, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Clay. Thanks for asking.
I have had numerous people reach out to me and suggest different guests, and you were on a great list that was sent to me, and really looking forward to working through that list. And they said that you were very knowledgeable guy to talk to about grazing issues and specifically holistic grazing. And then I had another request that somebody would wanted to kind of have a bit more of a deep dive, and they were coming from a traditional agriculture background, but their interest was piqued in the vein of holistic grazing. And so I guess where I'll start out is, if you were to find yourself coming into a piece of land that is depleted or has been depleted, and you were going to implement some holistic planned grazing, where would you start?
Well, the first thing is I'd want to get as good of a knowledge of my resource base as possible. So I would be doing some soil testing. I'm very excited about the Haney test, which is, you know, it just gives you a much more accurate view of what is available to plants, what the soil biology is, as opposed to the conventional soil tests that have been used for decades. So I would want to use the Haney test in addition to a conventional soil test for a basis of comparison. I'd want to get an idea, you know, do some walking through the fields, whether they're crop fields or pastures, tame pastures versus native pastures. Just get a rough idea, you know, how many species are we looking at in terms of forages? The grasses, the forbs, the legumes, what's there about, what is the carrying capacity, you know, what do we need for, do I have cows? Am I coming in here with cattle or with sheep or goats or what have you? Or am I going to come in with a combination of multiple species? For anybody just starting out, I always recommend, if you're going to, train wrecks happen. Train wrecks always happen. Manage for small train wrecks, because then you don't break the bank. And, it, you know, managing one species of ruminant is way easier than multiple species. So get one under your belt. Really get to know it. My preference to start with is cattle, but that's a cattle breeder, so I guess I'm biased. But, yeah, know your resource base. How much water is available, where it's available, and then what's my context? You know, what do I want? How do I want to live? You know, I mean, do I want to work 90 hours a week? Are my wife and kids ever going to see me? Do they want to participate in the operation? And if they do, you know, how do we do this so that our family can work together? Or if I'm doing this with business partners, how do we do this in a way that all of the stakeholders have a say? And, you know, if it doesn't work for somebody, then it's not going to work for anybody in an operation like that, not over the long haul. So first, you know, that resource base, what are we working with? And two, what's the context I want to be living in, working in? And then looking at, let's say you're in a farm slash ranch where some cropping has been done. I consider hay to be cropping, even if it's on perennial forages. I consider that cropping because you have to give back, right? You're taking something off. Are you going to feed it right back on that parcel, or are you going to be taking it to a lot someplace where you've got cattle dry lotted? I don't do that. I want animal impact on every square inch of whatever size operation I'm dealing with, because it's the interaction between the soil, the plant, and the animal. It's a closed loop, right? And if you take one of those elements out of the equation, if we don't consider what's going on in the soil, well, then we're going to be missing the big picture of, you know, we're going to start having to throw nitrogen, you know, NPK at our forages or at our crops because we're treating the soil as a basically just a substrate. You know, you might as well be doing hydroponics because you've killed everything off if you're not considering what's going on below the soil surface. That interaction between the plant and the animal, you know, when you have that trample effect and the grazing effect, that actually spurs growth so long as you haven't depleted your resource, you know, grazed it right down to a pool table. You've actually, you know, when you stimulate those plants then to produce a whole bunch of root exudates, mostly in the form of sugars, carbohydrates. That's where you start building organic matter in the soil. You're feeding the soil biology, which in turn feeds the plants. Those plants bounce back. They never slow down in their growth. And now you can make more rotations. You've got more productivity per unit area, which is really, now you can start thinking, okay, if I've got a saleable product in the form of milk or beef or lamb or wool, what have you, I want maximum net profit, not necessarily maximum net productivity in one species. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So thinking about, okay, well, I'm not monocropping. I'm not just doing corn and beans on this ground. I'm trying to get as many as 100 species of plants in an acre. I want as many species of animals, I want as much life as possible on that ground, because what that does is it builds resiliency. So in a drought year, I've actually got water holding capacity. So when you get that crazy 3-inch, 5-inch, 10-inch rain, and then nothing for weeks and weeks, the soil actually slowly releases that water back out. And, you know, it's like, what do they call it? Time release medications, you know, where you take an allergy pill on, you know, I've got wicked hay fever. So I take an allergy pill in the morning on Monday morning. I don't have to take another one until Tuesday morning. That's the kind of thing that you have when you're practicing this regenerative, adaptive, holistic planned grazing. Because you're looking at the big picture. It's not just about how much forage can you get into the animal, how much does the individual animal weigh going across the scale. It's how many pounds can come off of that land, you know. And so getting the animals in tune, in sync with nature, with, you know, calving in May, June instead of January, February, you know, those are aspects. But I'm rambling a little bit. I apologize, but that aspect of the 30,000 foot view, you know, what does this land look like? What is the soil condition? And then that gives me an idea of how best to utilize the tool of animal impact. Or if I'm going to be doing some cash cropping alongside my ranching operation, how do I integrate the two, you know, with cover crops like Gabe Brown and Steve Groff and Jeff Ramsey, I mean, you know, people that really know their cover cropping and how to utilize individual species within their region. You know, Gabe's in North Dakota, I'm in upstate New York. I'm going to use different species probably and different varieties of those species where my operation is versus where Gabe is. I get 30 odd inches of rain or precip a year. Gabe might get 15, you know, and maybe for some of your listeners there in South Dakota, it's going to be very similar to what Gabe's got in North Dakota. So, you know, so it really, I want to learn as much about the context of what the habitat that I'm dealing with, because really that's what the ranch, that's what the farm is a segment of habitat. You know, when we look at state lines and county lines and stuff on a map, those are arbitrary. You know, the buffalo, they didn't pay any attention to those things. When barbed wire started going up on range, they still didn't pay much attention to it, right? So, you know, an elk are even less, pay less attention to barbed wire. But that's, you know, having an idea of, you know, that how do I fit in here and work with the natural cycles and manage my domestic stock in a way. And so there's no silver bullet. There's no single recipe, but there are a number of tools that help me within my context, within my habitat, to change for the better what's going on. You know, how do I stimulate more life in the soil, which in turn stimulates more plant matter on top and more diversity on top of the soil, which then can sustain more animal diversity on the plant. So I don't know if that answers your question well, but frame of mind that I go into a new piece of property with.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. You know, we always want the silver bullet. We want the magic pill. We want to walk on there and say, this is what I'm going to do to this land without ever taking time to understand what this land is telling me to do to it first. And so I guess that's my next question is, how does that Haney test, or how does that observation of the species of grass and forbs and legumes on the land, how does that observational starting point inform your next step?
I'll give you a for instance. So on the place that I took over back in 2005, it had been primarily hayed for almost 30 years without anything being put back, no manure being spread, no fertilizer being spread, no lime being put down, and most of the fields were essentially goldenrod, hardhack, you know, gray dogwood, just mostly like primary succession plants, even though it was getting hayed, because the forage plants, the plants that you really, well, the cows really want, you know, the grasses, the legumes, they were just getting, there was nothing left in the soil. There was nothing really growing there. And so what I started doing with the management intensive grazing that I started with, that at least pre-selected for the plants that could handle that kind of 20, call it a 21-day rotation. The grasses and the legumes, the clovers just exploded. And the cool thing is your seed bank is there. Clover seed will stay in the, I mean, like I said, I'm in a humid environment, a very wet environment relative to like y'all in South Dakota. Clover seed will remain viable in the soil in my environment up to 80 years. I just have to provide the right growing condition. So if I start that 21-day rotation, that management intensive grazing type, you know, New Zealand style grazing, where everything remains vegetative, those species that can handle that will thrive. So the clovers, black medic, bird's foot trefoil, you know, those plants in the legumes will love that. The grasses, orchard grass, which is a bunch grass, the brome grass will start to peter out because we start getting into the you know, some of the sod forming grasses, other than bluegrass, which is a short grass, will start to peter out because they don't, their grazing, or not, I'm sorry, their growing point gets grazed off. And so you set them back. But, you know, some of the really good bunch grasses, and so on. So just by managing in that way, we're mimicking essentially what some people, you know, lawn mowing, golf courses, that's all recreational stuff, right? And we mimic that, and it selects the species that can handle that regime. That's great to get started with. I don't think management intensive grazing in that way, you know, is the ideal. I think heavy animal impact, you know, high stock density for a very short period of time, and then allowing a longer rest period in my environment, 45 days is pretty optimal. Some parts of the year, 30 days. But that kind of, that will jumpstart the life in the soil because the plants start exuding those sugars into the soil. The bacteria that have lain dormant or which are excreted out of the cow, you know, many of the most beneficial soil microbes are actually also gut microbes. So if they're not present or they're not real active on your place, getting your animals out there jumpstarts that. They every time a cow takes crap, she is laying, especially if she's grazing more mature forage, she's laying down pre-inoculated fertilizer packets with seed in it, right? And then she's going to preferentially not touch those plants that germinate in that cow pie, right? You get some feed refusal right around that cow pie, which allows those desirable plants to then become established. So anyway, so those are the things that I look at, you know, getting the animal impact. If I need to feed in the winter because, one, there's not enough stockpile of forage, or two, I've got crusty, you know, our snow here typically is pretty wet and it'll freeze, and then you get this crust of ice on top, and the cattle, yeah, they'll paw through it to a certain degree, but after a while they just will not go through it. So I'll bale graze, and you know, I set my bales out in the fall before the snow flies, and I'll put my cattle in, and what I'm doing, I don't make hay, I only purchase hay. So when I purchase that hay, I'm purchasing nutrients, I'm purchasing seed. Some people would say, well, what about all the weed seed you get? Well, I don't care about it. It's all just forage to me. Because what the cows don't eat, they'll trample, and when they trample it, it feeds the soil microbes. So when I bale graze, that's just an unbelievable opportunity to bring in carbon, NPK, micronutrients, and the cattle will work that in on pasture. And I don't have to start a tractor when it's 40 below. And I don't have to be out on that open camp tractor when it's 40 below. You know, it just works extremely, extremely well. And it jump starts that whole system.
Very, very good. Really appreciate that. I will note that I am continuing to record a few episodes in the same day, waiting alongside one of the busiest sections of Highway 85, possibly one of the busiest sections of two-lane highway anywhere in the world, just south of the center of the oil patch in western North Dakota. And I'm sitting here in a rainstorm, so there's wind and rain and lots of other noises going around that you might be hearing as I'm talking in the background. But in any case, I just wanted to make a note of that. And then I wanted to circle back to a couple of things you just mentioned there. First of all, you mentioned 45 days being optimal rest. We've talked about the fact there's no magic pill. There's no recipe for one context that everybody can apply to every context. We've got to know our context and then try to figure out our plan of action to impact that context in the most beneficial way for it. So when you say optimal rest, is that in any way a compromise, or is that amount of rest what is actually the very best for that piece of land?
Well, I'm talking about my particular operation.
Right.
45 days works out to be optimal. What's really important is to not fall into patterns, right? So, oh my gosh, I'm looking at the calendar and I'm coming up on 45 days and I'm not going to have the cows back where they were 45 days ago. Oh, what do I do? That's actually good. You want to change patterns often. Not humans are incapable of being completely random. We have biases, you know. We do stuff. We get into a habit. Before long, you got a footpath, and then it's a road, and then it's a 3-lane highway, and you know whatever. But to the extent we can, you know, grazing. Maybe it's in the early part of the season. You know, I'm just flashing the cattle through. They're going to do 5 rotations on the acreage allotted to me in 6 weeks, right? In March and April, there's not much growing going on in March and April. There's still a fair amount of snow, mud, this and that. I don't have the cattle bunched up tight in that scenario. They're spread out. In May, the forages are really starting to take off, and on my operation, I start calving. So I don't want to move them as often or as far, and I want them closer together. So when I check for calves, I'm able to mostly find them and get a tag in their ear. And, you know, mom's not getting up and moving and leaving her calf behind. I don't have, you know, orphans getting left behind. But all that said, the weather conditions are going to deter. Maybe I'm going to go back to feeding hay if it's a real hot, dry May and I'm not getting much forage growth, which would then change when those cattle hit the next paddock. So 45 days is just an average, but it seems to be an optimal on my operation.
Right.
An operation that I've got a little bit of knowledge of in Northeast Nevada, they try to be on a 14-month rotation. So the cattle are never in the same place at the same time, right? Rather than on a 12-month rotation, they're on a 14-month rotation. So they're always in a slightly different part of the ranch, or maybe a very different part of the ranch, and they've got 14 months of recovery,
mm-hmm.
right? So yep. Very different context.
Right. And I guess my question specifically is it a compromise at all that it's 45 days? Is there, you know, logistically, you know, are there things that you're just having to forego what would be better because of, you know, this, the limitation or whatever, I guess, if that makes sense?
No, because I'm not sticking to, I'm not being religious about the 45 days.
Right.
You know, maybe there's a kind of a pattern that has evolved on the farm and they're in this place, you know, and then 45 days later, the forage is just awesome there. Or for whatever reason, it's not awesome there, but it is in a different spot. Well, mm-hmm. then I'll move them to that other different spot. And the one that, you know, was going to be at the 45 day mark on the calendar, maybe that gets bumped out to 85 days.
Right.
Right. So the more important concept is flexibility, remaining flexible and adaptive in my thinking.
Sure.
And trying different things. You know, if it's real dry, oftentimes cowmen will put their cattle into bigger paddocks, spread them out, and that is exactly opposite of what you need to do. Mm. You know, what you really need to do when it's dry like that is tighten them right up. If you need to feed them, feed them. You're buying time for your plants to recover. That is really important because you don't want your animals on that, onto a plant or a whole bunch of plants, a paddock, too soon. That's when you start damaging root structure. That's when you start damaging the plant's ability to function well. And not only are you damaging the plants when you do that, you're damaging the fungi, the mycorrhizae underground. You're damaging the bacterial communities underground that are necessary to really propel your forages forward. So more rest is always better. Even when you say, oh man, that forage is just old and dry and dead and there's nothing there. Well, just tighten them up, let them trample what's there into the ground, and maybe they only eat 10%, and do more moves with that high stock density rather than fewer moves at low stock density. And you will, if it's real dry, you will also jumpstart forage because manure and urine are so high in water, and that will actually jumpstart growth even in a drought. So sure. It's you know, obviously you have to supply the water to your stock, but they move it for you to where it needs to be for the plants.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about the observation, and then a little bit about the mindset that you're going into this endeavor with. Is it too early to talk about necessary tools to accomplish some of these goals, or are there some things that we need to talk about before we get into infrastructure development, or how are you thinking about the next step?
No, along with knowing your resource base, knowing what tools are available. So in terms of infrastructure, you got to have water. It doesn't always have to be as close together as what some university folks would tell you. I mean, Johan Zeitzman and Alan Savory and others, Ian Mitchell Innes, who've been doing this for way longer than I have, the people who have developed these frameworks, you know, cattle will go a real long ways for water. The idea, though, is to utilize that behavior to accomplish some goal. You know, I've got a brother-in-law who just loves going to hot dog eating contests, and he's a competitive eater, you know. Guy's in great shape. You'd never guess it, but he loves doing buffalo chicken wing and hot dog eating contests and things like that. That's what you want to get into your cattle. You want them to be competitive eaters. When they hit a paddock, you know, the cow or if you're finishing cattle, whatever, you want them eating maybe half and trampling the other half, but utilizing those behaviors. So knowing the behavior, we have to be educated as to what are the behaviors. When animals walk into a paddock, what is the normal pattern? Well, they want to check out their boundaries. Okay, so, you know, when we set up our paddocks, how do we set them up? You know, when we have a water point, where do we put our minerals? Do we put the minerals right next to the water, or do we put them at the opposite corner of that paddock or that cell? If we put it at the opposite corner, well, now we're emphasizing foot traffic. We're emphasizing that trample. We're facilitating the animal behavior to accomplish the task that we need, which is trampling forage onto the ground. Whatever doesn't go into the animal should be trampled onto the ground. And what that does is it provides armor. That's the term that Gabe Brown uses, armor for the soil surface. So if you think about a roller crimper and what we would do with a cover crop, rolling it down, basically that's a man-made tool that mimics what a herd of cattle will do. When we utilize a polywire fence or other fencing methods, we're mimicking what happens to herbivores, large ruminants, in the presence of predators. They bunch together. They trample. They eat. They move around as a herd from one spot to another as a bunch in the same way that they would in the presence of wolves, or if you're in Africa, it'd be hyenas and lions and cheetahs and all of those critters. So knowing what our objective is on any given piece of ground tells us how big of an area to give our cattle or goats or sheep or whatever. It tells us a little bit about how we want to set some things up in terms of water placement, mineral placement, that type of thing. And then that informs how we, you know, we're the ones with the forward facing eyes and the opposable thumbs and the, you know, smartphones in our pocket. So we're the ones that have to make these management decisions. So we have to be educated about animal behavior, why things work the way they do. So I always encourage people to read as much as possible, to listen to, you know, podcasts like yours, Clay, to get into some of the chat groups on social media that are talking about regenerative grazing, that are talking about cover cropping, that are talking about animal behavior. Those are great resources, you know. So, yeah, the tools, you know, really it's capitalizing on managing the animal behavior to achieve our objectives, where we insert ourselves to the minimum possible in a natural ecosystem. Really what we want to do is mimic that natural ecosystem to the maximum extent we can and make a living at it.
So I was about to ask you if you could define the term holistic planned grazing, but I think you just did. So, I mean, I don't know if there's any more you would add to that, but, you know, just kind of to maybe, I know we're just scratching the surface here and hopefully piquing some interest and causing people to join some Facebook groups and dive deeper and some of those things, but just to make sure that we've answered the question, what is holistic planned grazing, helping managing our animals in such a way that they mimic nature in a way that is profitable for us financially and for the land ecologically. I mean, what else would you add to that?
Well, I would just make sure that folks understand holistic planned grazing is a tool. It's not holistic management. Holistic management takes into account holistic planned grazing, certainly, but it's a tool that we modify as necessary to achieve our goals. And we want to hit a triple bottom line when we talk about holistic management. So the environmental bottom line, the social bottom line, you know, I talked about, you know, knowing the context that my family and I want to live in and work in, or my business partners and I, and so on. And then the financial bottom line, got to pay our bills, right? So minimizing cost of production by utilizing these tools, by allowing animals to behave the way they were created to behave, and then capitalizing on it. So that reduces cost, but it also can, and almost inevitably does, increase the productive capacity of the land we're on, so that we're reducing cost and increasing productivity at the same time, which means there's a bigger margin. So I just want to make sure, to the extent that I can, that folks understand that holistic planned grazing is only one part of holistic management. It is a suite of tools.
Sure. Very, very good. Very helpful. As I said, I'm not trying to send people away from here with a PhD level certificate on these practices or holistic management as a whole, but I do want to give you the opportunity to share some of the things that you're involved in that can help people along this way of getting more educated and preparing themselves to be better managers of the land and the animal resources.
Sure, cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, the resources that are out there are fortunately growing rapidly. I would say, you know, if folks are interested, check out Understanding Ag LLC or understandingag.com. That's Gabe Brown and Ray Archuleta, David Brandt, Alan Williams. They do these soil health academies all over the world now. They're just a tremendous resource. The Savory Institute, savory.global, Again, just a tremendous resource. And of course, Alan Savory is the sort of the progenitor of this concept of holistic management. He coined the phrase. And it has been a work in progress for decades. There are folks in different parts of the country, you know, whether it's Josh Dukart in North Dakota or Bill Hodge down in Georgia or Gabe Brown in North Dakota or Chris Kirsten in California or Aaron Lusich in California or Jason Snavely in Pennsylvania. I mean, just looking up those names and seeing what they're involved in. And, you know, Steve Groff, and if you want to get into cover cropping, Steve's is just a tremendous resource. So it's really trying to expand, you know, our concept outside the boundaries of our own farm or ranch and start thinking about habitat and ecosystem. And then how does our farm or our ranch, how does our family fit into that ecosystem without us imposing upon it? I guess that's kind of where my head is these days.
Sure. Very good, Morgan. I really appreciate your time. WorkingCows.net/99 will be the show notes page for today. There will be links to most of what Morgan just mentioned there at WorkingCows.net/99. So go ahead and check that out and continue to educate yourself. Morgan, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thank you, Clay. All the best. I wish you well.
All right. Episode 100 coming up next, and I will get it out to you as soon as possible. Excited to share it with you. The longest episode to date in the history of the Working Cows podcast, so really excited to have the opportunity to share that with you guys, and I hope that you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording it and getting it ready for your ears. So be on the lookout for that real soon, and we will see you again with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.